Christians are called to be loving and generous and provide care for the poor. But have Christians been going about it the wrong way? Today, our guest has a fresh take on how to best lift people out of poverty that may challenge what you've always thought. Welcome once again to Ego Forum Live with well-known conservative commentator Phyllis Schlafly. Phyllis brings you the most important issues of concern to the family every week. We'll have her back to you next week. I think you probably know she's going to be in Tampa, and we'll root for good weather, or improved weather at least. And today, Cynthia Davis and her special guest will look at the causes and the cures of poverty. And now, here's Cynthia Davis.
And we are living through tough economic times right now. Most of us know someone who's struggling. Misguided politicians frequently try to offer solutions, but in the end, we're left with more government programs and more nanny state. So Christians agree we're supposed to take care of the poor, but many aren't sure of the best way to do it. So today, our guest will help us sort out some answers that are both biblically and economically sound. This morning, we have Michael Matheson Miller. He's a research fellow and director of media at the Acton Institute in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's also appeared in three Zondervan DVD series on biblical stewardship, human freedom, and ethics. Michael is currently leading the Poverty Cure, which promotes enterprise solutions to poverty. So, Michael, we're delighted to have you today. What a thrill to have you. You know, one thing that intrigued me so much about you is how many good-hearted people care deeply for the poor. They put so much effort into figuring out the causes of poverty, and yet all it ends up doing is growing government bigger. So what do you mean by poverty, and how are we going to cure it?
Well, Cynthia, thanks for having me on your show. It's a delight to be here. You know, one thing I think about poverty before we begin is that poverty isn't really a disease. I mean, we kind of talked about poverty cure. I think it's important to say it's not a disease. But it is sometimes a block to human flourishing, to allowing people to exercise all their opportunities and God-given talents. And I also think that, you know, you talked about how Christians think about poverty. I mean, Christians, I think we recognize that there's no single solution to poverty. That there's material poverty, there's spiritual poverty, there's moral poverty, and that ultimately we're never going to, like, solve all things. There will always be poverty because there will always be tragedy. There will always be human error. So I think in the beginning, before we kind of come up to some utopian solution, like, if we just do the following five things, everything will be better, and that's just not going to happen. And I would even say that that's one of the great challenges of modern political and economic life. Both on the right and the left. We always want some single solution that's going to solve everything. And politics is not going to solve everything. Economics is not going to solve everything. But that doesn't mean we can't really work hard and try to improve the opportunity for millions of people around the world who are really in extreme poverty.
Well, and I saw that myself after being in the legislature for 8 years. Every solution that government came up with still ended up with a poor result, and we're not solving the problems that we meant to solve. You know, Acton's motto was coupling good intentions with sound economics. So what makes your approach different, and how can we get back to combating real poverty instead of using children as human shields to grow government bigger?
Well, I think some of the first things that we have to ask, right, is that usually we look at poverty, whether it's in the United States but especially, say, in the developing world, in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, and we say, boy, what causes poverty? And why are those people so poor? But really, that's not the right question. The right question is, what causes wealth? How do we create the conditions so that families and individuals and communities can create wealth and prosperity for themselves, so they don't need to be dependent on charity, they don't need to be dependent on government assistance, that they can actually create wealth and prosperity in their own community? So the first thing is to ask that. The second thing is, I think when we think about poverty, you know, Christians have a heart for the poor. When the announcer announced, like, you know, Christians, how do we think about poverty? Well, I think, one, it's very clear. We are called by God to help the poor, to take care of the widow and the orphan. The book of James says that pure religion is this, to care for the widow and orphan in their distress. So we are called to take care of the poor. And we are called to have a heart for the poor. But God also calls us to have a mind for the poor. We're not just supposed to do random acts of kindness. We're not just supposed to have sentiment for the poor. The goal is to help the poor with the work in partnership, not in a paternalism, but in a partnership way where we work together with the poorest of the poor to help them create, help create the conditions so they can create wealth and prosperity. So the problem, I think, is that we've had a model, whether it's in the United States or internationally, is if somehow if the government can kind of come in and jumpstart development, if the government can kind of take this role, then it will create prosperity in Africa and create prosperity where, you know, in the United States or whatever. But what we found over 60 to 100 years is that this really hasn't achieved the results it was hoped for. It hasn't worked. So, for example, we've given a lot of money in foreign aid with the idea that we could kind of skip into the industrial era and really help these economies develop. What we've seen, though, is that foreign aid has sometimes subsidized dictators. It's created inefficiencies. A lot of foreign aid actually doesn't get to the poor. Foreign aid actually goes to companies in the United States or in Europe who get contracts that they really wouldn't get in a free market. And so what we've done is that we've taken this idea that somehow we can just jumpstart and create prosperity. But that's not the way that the United States, that's not the way that Europe, that's not the way that, that prosperous countries and communities got out of poverty. They get out of poverty when they create the conditions for entrepreneurs and business people and families to take responsibilities for themselves and create wealth and prosperity. See, part of the problem is I sometimes think that we can look at poor people and think they're different from us. Right? They're like a poor entrepreneur in Africa. You think, well, they're nothing like us. Well, that's not true. They just don't have private property and rule of law. They don't have free association and free exchange. And so we're often, I think, we take this idea of the poor that we forget their creative capacity. And so we end up actually doing things that want to help. Right? We want to help, but we end up actually creating situations that are bad. Let me give you an example. Okay? For the Poverty Cure Project, I've done probably close to 150 interviews from people from all over the world. And I interviewed a guy here in the United States called Peter Greer who does microfinance. And he came to this realization when a church in Atlanta was giving eggs to a community in Rwanda. Because this was after the Rwandan genocide. People were hungry. There was, you know, tragedy. There was a social breakdown. And so a church decided, we're going to do something good. We're going to give eggs to this community in Rwanda, all right? Now, nobody would say, oh, that's a bad idea. Of course it's a good idea, right? Well, what they didn't realize, however, is that in that community that they were giving free eggs to, there was an entrepreneur who saw the need for eggs, who bought some hens, and started a little business. Well, when the free eggs came, it put that guy out of business. And the next year when the church said, okay, we've done our good here, it's time to move on to a new community, there were no eggs in that community, and they were actually worse off than they were before because sometimes our charity actually hurts.
Right.
Our desire to give foreign aid or NGOs, non-governmental organizations, which we can talk about in more detail.
Yeah, well, no, that leads to a question.
They do worse. They actually make the situation worse instead of actually helping because they delay the development of business.
And what is your opinion of the church? Many churches sponsor short-term missions trips where people raise support and then go to a foreign country, spend 2 or 4 weeks there, build buildings or infrastructure, and then after they leave, what kind of long-term impact have you observed after they leave the community? So now I've given you a little time to reflect on short-term missions trips. How helpful are those in international countries in the long run?
Well, that's a really good question, Cynthia. I mean, first of all, let's say there's something just very good about short-term mission trips. Why? Because it's a lot of young people, but other people in the church go into foreign countries. They get to learn about how other people live. It's really an example of Christian solidarity. It's the church not just giving money to the government and saying, you take care of the poor, but the church actually taking responsibility, living out Christian solidarity and what you'd call the principle of subsidiarity, where those closest to the problems deal with it. So there's a lot of positive things, too. You know, maybe young people are on that mission trip. They're living in a highly consumer society. They get down and realize, wow, you know, a lot of people are really poor, and they're not unhappy because they don't have iPods, right? But they also recognize maybe the opportunities that we have and can be more grateful for them. There are some problems, of course. I think one of the problems is you gave the example of going down to build a church. Well, why is it that, say, American, middle-aged Christians are going down to build churches in the developing country? Why instead aren't they hiring the people there to build their own churches? Maybe they can help them by training. Maybe they can help them with financial needs. But get them involved. I mean, it's almost a joke. Why would we go down, if there's high levels of employment, why would we go down to, say, Central America and do work and not hire the people who live down there? And then they say, well, I need a job. And so they leave their country. Sometimes they come here to find a job. I mean, it's almost ironic, right? So that's the one question is, are the projects actually for the people coming down there, or are they for the people that they're going to try to help? And I think it can be for both. All right, then the second thing. But the second thing, I think, is that one of the big problems with short-term mission trips is actually an intellectual problem, Cynthia. People go down to the developing world, and they see poor people, maybe for the first time in their life. And it's pretty powerful. I mean, you get down to a place, and you think, golly, I mean, how do people live like this? And you're kind of moved. And you see lots of people, lots of children, and they think, we've got to do something.
Well, I appreciate... Yeah,
and to finish this point, they think we've got to do something. But a lot of times, what they think we need to do actually makes the problem worse.
I agree.
One of the reasons we created Poverty Cure and the Poverty Cure video curriculum is to actually say, okay, now you've been in the developing world or you're about to go, let's think about what's actually taking place instead of what you think in a two-week trip.
Right. And Bruce and I were just sitting here enjoying our coffee. And the question is, what about this fair trade stuff? I mean, if I could go on a missions trip anywhere, I'd like to go to Colombia so I could enjoy the coffee. But how does fair trade, and now you see that in the grocery stores, how does that affect those developing countries?
Well, fair trade is actually a little complex. There are different kinds of fair trade. And so I don't want to get super pedantic but on the radio here, but actually at povertycure.org, you can go look, and we have an issue page on fair trade, and we have a book written by Victor Klar on fair trade, so you can learn about a little book, about 100 pages, 80 pages. So if people are interested in fair trade, you can go look at that. But let me say that I think one of the good ideas of fair trade is they're saying, well, let's make sure that there aren't slaves and bad working conditions, et cetera. I think it's a positive attitude. There are some problems, however, with fair trade, and some of the farmers that say, look, it's not worth it for me to take fair trade. I have to pay, say, several thousand dollars to be able to get fair trade certified, and so the money that I actually pay to get fair trade certified, I don't even make up in all of my sales. So the question right now is it actually helping the poorest of the poor, or is it a feel-good approach, okay, to the way we deal with poor people? And the other question is, what the poor really need is not so much the fair trade moniker of a fair trade sign. They need real fair trade, which is free and competitive markets. Let me give you an example of what I mean. What do we do oftentimes with American and European agriculture? We subsidize American agriculture to quote unquote protect the small farmer. Well, I've talked to small farmers in the United States that we're not protected by that. In fact, it's hard for us to compete against big business and big government in cahoots, managerial corporate capitalism. Poor farmers, small farmers in America, they're not really benefited. So it's not even really protecting the small farmer. What we do is we subsidize our agriculture. We put tariffs on so that developing countries can't sell. It's hard to sell in Europe and the United States. Then oftentimes we'll even overproduce and we'll send over the food as foreign aid. And then what do? We undermine their local farms. And then there's anger, and they think, why are you angry at capitalism? We call that free market capitalism. Cynthia, that's not free market capitalism. That's managerial capitalism. That's Davos, Switzerland capitalism, where all these celebrities and bureaucrats get together to plan the economy. But it's not a free economy. And I think what the poorest of the poor need is free exchange. And if you give me a second here, let me say something, because I think that shocks people. First of all, what the poor need is private property. Some places, 70% of the land has no title. You don't know who owns the land. So how could you work on, how are you going to improve it if you don't know who owns it and somebody can take it away from you? Second of all, they need rule of law. Hernando de Soto did a study, and he tried to set up a little sewing shop in Peru. And they were going to follow it, all the laws, to register the business. They got four lawyers on the street, 8 to 5, every day, to sign up the business. Cynthia, how many days do you think it took for them to sign up the business officially?
How many?
289 days.
Oh, my, that's more than half a year.
And you know what he found out? He said the legal systems are unfriendly to poor people.
Right. Well, I remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and let's say that free exchange, setting up a business, but also free exchange. I've talked to a lot of people, Cynthia, about this, and I say free exchange, and they think, oh, but won't competition hurt the poor? Well, I've talked to a lot of people in Africa and Latin America and other places, and they say, no, we want competition. You can see this on the poverty cure curriculum. Listen to their voices. We want competition. Let us compete, they say. And here's why. And this is actually very important for the United States, too. Okay? Here's why. We often think, oh, free exchange, capitalism, you know, that just helps the big guy. Well, no. Actually, it's really what helps the little guy and the medium guy. Why? Because when you have the government involved in economics, what you do is you create a system where big businesses have huge lobbying offices in Washington, D.C., or Paris, or Lima, or Accra, or Brussels, or wherever it might be. It's the big companies that lobby the governments, and they create regulations that actually prevent competition. And the poorest of the poor, the small and medium entrepreneur in sub-Saharan Africa or in Arkansas, they don't have the political, the social, and the economic contacts to navigate this massive bureaucracy. They don't have people with lobbying firms. So what we really need is free exchange. And this goes to the heart of America, too. We don't have a free market economy here. We have managerial capitalism. That's what got us into this mess. And then all of these guys who plan the economy, you know what they told us after the crisis? They said, free markets don't work. We'll help you get out of it. No, you guys are the ones who got us in the first place.
Hey, Michael Miller. Michael Miller, Cynthia Davis is guest hosting today, and we also have a number of calls. So let's see in Oklahoma City. Bot Radio Network brings us Sharon to the conversation. Hi, Sharon. Go right ahead. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Michael. I really appreciated all of your comments, especially those on fair trade and the micro business opportunities overseas. I actually work for an international NGO, and I'm a missionary kid, so I've seen firsthand some of that you mentioned. My question today is specifically, how can we address this in our poverty issues here in the United States? Like, I'm thinking in specifics like Christmas assistance. You know, we know many communities offer that type of outreach to what we view as in poverty, you know, folks in poverty or with food scarcity issues. When you look at trying to view this in an entrepreneurial sense, you run into all of the labor laws and all of those things if they become wage earners through a program. How do you address this in this way in the U.S.?
Hi, Sharon. Thanks for your question. Super good question. So let me just say before I try to answer that for you, and I'll try my best. If you're an NGO, you know, at Poverty Cure, we have over 160 partners.
Mm-hmm.
So if your organization is interested in joining up, that'd be great. Go to the PovertyCure.org website, and you can go to the network. And we'd love to have you a part of it. Like us on Facebook, too, and get some updates. And thanks for all your service and your questions. Let me try my best. I mean, you asked some important questions, like with Christmas assistance and how you help. I mean, there's two. Let me try to answer it in two parts as quick as I can. One, you know, and we deal with this also in the Poverty Cure curriculum, interviewing in the domestic poverty questions. Like, people like Neil Johnson, Robert Woodson, and Rudy Carrasco talk about this a lot, and you can see them at our website. But they gave examples of, like, you know, we'll kind of help somebody, and they would give gifts to the children. And what happened is the parents felt disenfranchised, and they felt not very important. So one of the things I think the best way we do assistance is to get families involved. Especially as Christians, we understand that we're not radical individualists. Right, children aren't, they don't just pop out. No, they are born into families. And that we need to be thinking when we sponsor children and take care of children, are we thinking of them in terms of the family, or are we thinking of them in terms of a radical individual? And how then do we empower families so they feel that they're part of it, so we're not just giving things away and creating individualism instead of empowering the family? I think that's one theoretical question. The practical question is, what do you do about all these laws? You know, that actually relates directly to the last thing I was talking about corporate capitalism. There's a farmer in the United States. His name is Joel Salatin. If any of your listeners, Cynthia, have heard and seen the movie Food, Inc., he's in Food, Inc. He's in the other movie Fresh. And Joel calls himself a Christian, organic, libertarian, capitalist farmer. He's classic. I interviewed him. I went to his farm in Virginia. And he wrote a little book called Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. And he gets to the question that Sharon's asking.
And good afternoon. It's so pleasurable to be with everybody today. And Michael Miller, we're thrilled to have you with us, especially since you've studied poverty. And at some level, this topic actually does affect all of us. The biggest argument for socialized health care is that poor people can't afford it for themselves. So do fellow citizens owe their poorer neighbors socialized health care under God's commandment to care for the poor?
Well, fellow citizens, I think we do have, as Christians, responsibility. We are our brother's keeper. But I think the one confusion is somehow in modern life, we have conflated Christian solidarity and care for the poor with, therefore, the state must do everything. And that's just not the case. And I think, you know, and the whole idea that somehow that it really helps the poor, this goes back to the question that Sharon asked, because the question that we were talking about within the developing world is, actually, the more bureaucratized it gets, the harder it is for the poor to manipulate it. It actually tends to favor the wealthy. And we've seen this with the National Health Services in the UK. I mean, this data is right there.
Well, you know, the concern that we all should have as Christians is that we're going to see economic arguments for why we should abort defective babies or euthanize elderly because now it's not economically feasible to spend money on people who are going to die shortly. And this is the concern. When the government is paying for it, then there do become different decisions. So the question is, how can we argue for protecting innocent life for those whose existence doesn't make it economically feasible any longer, especially when we now have the government funding this?
Well, Cynthia, you always ask like 10 questions in one, but I'm trying my best. I think, first of all, we need to make both economic arguments and we need to make moral arguments. And this is a problem. I think sometimes we only make an economic argument. We need to make a moral argument for the dignity and value of every human life. And human beings have value not just because they're useful, right? Utility is a value, but it's not the only value. And so, first of all, we need to just and never give up on that. But on the economic argument, look, you talked about abortion. You know, let's look at what's happened in the developing world, and let's look at what's happening here in the United States. We actually, there's a fallacy that you get. I talked about one of the reasons we have the poverty curriculum is all the fallacies. One of the fallacies people get when they go to the poor countries is they see all these poor people. And they think, oh, golly, if there were fewer people, there'd be more money to go around, right? Now, it's true that if, you know, everybody in your office got together, pooled their money into a pile, and then half of them were killed, and then you redistributed the money, you'd have more money. Yeah, for a day, for 2 days. But all the productive capacity of those other human beings is gone. So look what's happened in the developing world. We have spent billions of dollars internationally to the United States and European countries and UN and all these people are spending billions of dollars to encourage people to have small families and to have population control. Well, guess what's happened? When you encourage people to have small families, and they do, what kind of children do they opt for?
Well, they opt for the most productive and boys.
Well, no, they opt for a certain kind of children. They
the
opt
boys.
For a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you have what the New York Times has called the daughter deficit and what the cover of The Economist magazine has called gendercide. What happened to 100 million missing baby girls? The effect of this is bad economics and it's bad anthropology of understanding who the human person is. Human people can produce much more than they consume when given the opportunity. Human beings are creative. We're created in the image of God, not only with dignity and value, but also to be creative and productive and innovative. And so what's happened is we have literally gotten rid of 100 million or more baby girls.
Well, that's true.
And you know what? The economic impact of that is huge. Plus, can you imagine all these men without women? What did God say when man was alone? It's not good. Well, let me tell you something. It's not going to be good when you have hundreds of millions of young men with no women.
So what's the economic forecast for what's going to happen in China?
Golly, Cynthia, that's a good question. I mean, I'm not an expert on China. That's a too big of a question. But I would say that we are going to see some real impact on this demographic thing. I mean, the birth ratios in China are, I think, close to like 120 to 105. For every 105 girls, there's 120 boys. That's a lot. It doesn't seem like a lot, but you add that up over time with lots of people, that's a lot of single men running around. So we'll see what happens there.
Mike,
a great piece by Nicholas Eberstadt. You can read it called The Global War on Baby Girls by Nick Eberstadt.
Hey, Michael and Cynthia, I want to insert another caller here. This is Joe checking in from Fayetteville, Arkansas, listening to Bot Radio Network. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I think what the guest is saying is generally very, very good. I agree with him on pretty much everything. But one point I do want to disagree with him on is when he said that tariffs promote poverty. And that the best economic book I've ever read, it was called Unforgiven by Charles Walters, Jr. It explained this point very well. This man really looked into the records of it, you know, how the situation actually worked. And he found that when the United States, for instance, had tariffs on imported stuff, then that kept the wages of the American worker up. So the American worker had more money with which to buy not only American goods, but also imported goods. So on the whole, more American and imported goods were sold in the United States. But when the United States had free trade and didn't have tariffs, then this lowered the wages of the American worker because the American worker had to compete with the lower wages of the workers around the world. And so then American workers had less money with which to buy both American and imported stuff. So what free trade does without tariffs is it tends to lower the wages of workers all over the world to the level of the lowest paid workers anywhere in the world so that workers overall have less money to buy anything from anywhere. And so this explains that tariffs help to keep wages up. Therefore, working people have more money with which to buy more goods of all sorts. And so I'd like to guess comments on that.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for your question. It's a good one, and I'm going to give just a partial answer because of time. One is that if you actually look at data globally and over time, it is very true that you can use tariffs on a short-term way, and that can have some positive effects, especially, say, the United States after World War II, economic giant, able to do a lot of things internally, et cetera. But if you look long-term, that, in fact, free trade, because of the principles of a comparative advantage and competitive advantage with tariffs, actually lowers not just wages, but lowers, I mean, you talked about lowering wages, it actually lowers prices, okay? And so the thing is, if you look at all of the countries who've tried import substitution policies, which is basically creating tariffs to kind of protect domestic jobs, you find that generally they have failed in the long term. There's also the negative effect of tariffs that you can't see, and this is the principle of economics. You can read Henry Hazlitt's book, Economics in One Lesson, right in the beginning, or Thomas Sowell's Basic Economics, where they explain that economics is not just looking at one group over at one period of time, but all the groups over every period of time. So let me give you an example. I think it was during the Bush administration we created tariffs on steel to protect the American steelworker. And so Chinese steel, you couldn't import it, you know, at lower prices, so the American steel companies could work. And it actually did effectively protect the American steelworker. But it also raised the price on steel. So that means steel-using industries, like automobile and other steel-using industries, what they actually did is they couldn't compete. So some of them closed down their factories, and they moved to Mexico and to other places. And then you have outsourcing. So what you do is you think, wait a minute, oh, people are terrible, they're outsourcing. Yeah, that's because we created a tariff on one industry, which made the users of that product, it made them unable to compete globally, and then they had to shut down and move to another country, and all those people lost their jobs, and then we blame free markets. So I would actually argue that yes, you can give specific examples where tariffs have had benefit. That's I don't think debatable. But over the long run, for the country, lowering prices for a long-term economic opportunity, nothing is fairer and more just than a free, competitive market.
And I'd like to ask you a few questions about morality as well, because there is so much to be done with our ethical standards. And maybe you can explain this one to us, how we've seen the moral decline make it harder for people to generate fair income. You know, statistically, people who are married are much less likely to be poor. And so what can the church do to interject itself and shape the public policy to encourage more marriage?
Again, Cynthia, multifaceted questions. I'll try my best. You're fun. Okay. I mean, clearly, there, you're right. There is a connection between marriage and not being married and being in poverty. A few single mothers, a very high chance of being in poverty, et cetera. I think so you actually ask a fundamental question of what is important for the moral standards for a free and prosperous society. You know, our founders recognized that in order for us to have a free society, we needed the free, you know, free self-governing institutions. We needed to be free, self-governing people. You can't have a free society without a strong moral culture. Lord Acton, of course, from the Acton Institute where I work, Lord Acton said famously that that liberty is the delicate fruit of a mature civilization. And so one of the things I think that we're seeing is when we look at a breakdown of a moral culture and breakdown of marriage and breakdown of these things, it has negative effects on whether we can stay not only a free politics, but a free economy. And so you absolutely need a moral base. And the foundation of this moral base, of course, is in the family. And so if you look, for example, at socialist writings from the 19th century, and you look at writers from Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels to Antonio Gramsci and the Fabian socialists in the U.K., Gramsci said, we're going to make a long march through the institutions of culture. And all of these guys, even though they disagreed on a lot, agreed on there were three primary obstacles to socialistic social reform. And those were, they were private property, religion, remember the religion is the opiate of the people line, and what was the third one? It was, quote-unquote, this present form of marriage.
Michael Miller visiting today here on Ego Forum Live. Cynthia Davis is pinch-hitting for Phyllis. By the way, after this program, Cynthia goes to a sound-alike project at a nearby studio for Sarah Palin. Anybody ever sound exactly like Sarah Palin? If you want to join in the conversation, we're at 800-736-3202. We'd like to have you join us. There's a lot more to come right here on Ego Forum Live. You're listening to Ego Forum Live with well-known conservative commentator and the author of more than 20 books, Phyllis Schlafly. Phyllis away this week. Of course, we'll have her back to you next week. Cynthia Davis is pinch-hitting today for Phyllis Schlafly. The special guest is Michael Miller, talking about some innovative ways to cure poverty. As a matter of fact, you can Google poverty cure. You'll see Michael Miller all over the web. You can check out his DVDs. And, of course, you're welcome to call in and dialogue on this program right now at 800-736-3202. Our next stop is North Platte, Nebraska, listening to Bot Radio Network. Here's Lonnie. Hi, Lonnie.
Good morning. Thank you very much for the topic. I was going to talk on something else, but I'll just get in the big one. How do we deal with the fact that the American worker, because of unemployment, OSHA, FICA, workman's comp, so forth and so on, is really more expensive to an employer than what they can produce? Right. Second question has to do with, I don't hear anything here that represents anything that the Bible talks about with respect to those who are believers dealing with poverty. It's troubling to me, especially when it comes to the fact that most individuals in poverty are single mothers, and by the encouragement of working, they would not be considered widows indeed for funds that came from the church.
Go ahead, Michael.
Thanks, Lonnie. Thanks for your question. There's two of them. Let me answer the first one, the second one first, and I'll try to do it quickly because I know that we have limited time. But you can also learn more at povertycure.org, and I also encourage you to go to the Acton Institute website at www.acton.org. For this question, I mean, one of the things we do at Acton is the intersection between moral philosophy and theology and economics and entrepreneurship. So there's a lot of work there that we've done and a lot of books to read there. As far as the Bible goes, I mean, first of all, the three or four key principles. I mean, number one, the dignity of the human person created in the image of a loving God is central to understand how to get out of poverty. Creative nature of the human person created for human flourishing and a rich life. Number two, and I don't mean the prosperity gospel. I mean created for human flourishing, which when I say a rich life, I don't mean materially rich. I mean morally rich. It just so happens to be that many of the things that allow for human flourishing also allow for economic development. So, for example, private property is essential. You can see it from the Ten Commandments through the prophets in the New Testament, in the church fathers, doctors, reformers. Every Christian tradition recognizes the importance of private property. The rule of law is central to the Christian tradition of justice. The ability to join together for things that are common good come out of the Christian tradition. I mean, this whole understanding of what made the West successful and wealthy comes from Christian civilization. There's a lot of things you can read. One of the things we produce is a curriculum called the Birth of Freedom curriculum, and also also before that, the Birth of Freedom documentary. You can find those at Acton or at thebirthoffreedom.com, and we explain a lot of those things. So, for super important question, and I'm glad you asked it. The first question was, it's really hard for the American worker because it's actually hard to hire people because it costs so much to hire them. I mean, this is exactly a huge problem. This goes to Sharon's question, which I didn't have time to finish answering. And that is, again, this farmer wrote this book, Joel Salatin, Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. By the way, on my website, CynthiaMichaelMathisonMiller.com, I'm building a reading list. So I've been mentioning books and everything, and so a lot of people say, hey, what should I read? So I'm building a reading list on a whole host of topics from poverty to philosophy of love, to prayer, beauty, and children's stories. So I'm building this reading list at MichaelMathisonMiller.com.
And I appreciate you doing that because our biggest problem is Christians aren't really addressing the issue. You're certainly not hearing any of this from the pulpit, and or from many pulpits have been quiet. And the few pulpits who do talk about poverty, they put a guilt trip on everybody, like we should be donating more money to big organizations. And we're not sure. Hey, when the Bible said love your neighbor, I mean, it meant you. It didn't say pay more taxes so that your government can love your neighbor. So the question is, are we losing the cultural debate? I mean, we have really slid down with not having great answers until I got connected with Acton and found out there's something beyond just pay more taxes. And when we're seeing government programs grow bigger, how are we going to get the cultural debate back on track?
Well, Cynthia, I'm going to answer that really fast. Let me just finish with Lonnie really fast, and that is, Lonnie, I think you're absolutely hitting a point on the difficulty. When the government creates so many regulations to quote-unquote help, it actually makes unemployment higher because people it gets hard to hire. Look at Italy, for example. The unemployment rates are crazy because the labor market is so tight because you can't hire and you can't fire. And so I think you're hitting on something important. So I recommend people to read Salatin's book, Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. And explains how actually government's attempts to help actually make things worse. Cynthia, your question on cultural debate, I mean, first of all, I would say politics is not going to win the cultural debate. Getting the president and control of the Senate, you know, having Republican in the presidency or control of the Senate, that's not going to win the cultural debate. Okay, the cultural debate, in fact, much of it is already lost. And I'm not a pessimist. I'm hopeful. I have confident expectation that Jesus will deliver me, so I'm hopeful. But I think that part of the problem is sometimes we think about politics, and that's not the answer. Politics just reveals a spiritual condition of the people. It reveals culture. So I think what we need to do is a multi-faceted approach. We need to be thinking harmonically across the culture. We need to be thinking about marriage, about institutions. For example, I would argue that the secular left pretty much has control of the major institutions in American life that shape culture, from universities to government schools to media, television, art, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's going to be very difficult for Christians and those who believe in the traditional understanding of Western civilization to recapture culture. If we only focus on politics, we have to rethink about how we're going to get the institutions. And I also think we need to think like Christians. And I would actually argue that a lot of us, and I include myself here, how often do we actually think like secularists? about truth, about reason, about a whole host of things. I really think it's important that we think like Christians. And so I'll give one example that I think everybody should read. It's, and I know some of your Protestant listeners are going to be like, what? But Benedict the 16th, in 2005, gave a speech in Germany called the Regensburg Address, which had got a lot of attention because it was the one that created riots because he was talking about Islam and things like that. But it, everybody kind of missed the point. The main point of that is really a defense of reason, of moral reasoning. And this is complex, but Cynthia, it's super important. If we make every argument that we can only make is empirical, and we can't make a moral argument reasonably, we're never going to win any cultural war. And so I would encourage people to read this Regensburg Address, think about it, because we need to recapture our understanding of reason, we need to think like Christians, and we need to think about institutionally how do we capture culture and not just focus on politics. I'm not saying politics isn't important, but I'm saying we've had a lot of Republican-controlled House and Senate, et cetera, et cetera, but the culture move to secularism and to radicalism has kept going during the 80s, during the 90s, and during the first decade of the 2000s. This thing has been going on for years, and it's because the secular left runs and controls the institutions of culture.
And we're watching government grow bigger every year despite who's in control. And meanwhile, family, church, and community are becoming less effective and less of a factor. You said that in one of your lectures, that the family, church, and community naturally will limit government, and when they diminish, we're going to see government naturally grow bigger. Yet those liberals who are trying to push it the other way, you've got people saying, no, it's up to the individual. And you made the point. Can you explain how we're in trouble if it's all individuals fighting the bigger government?
No, I'll try and shorten on the radio. That's a super good question. I mean, you know, this is a paradoxical thing. Individualism, Alexis de Tocqueville says, leads to centralization. Now, a lot of conservatives think, well, individuals, that's individual responsibility, you know, et cetera. That's great, but what's actually happening is we have increasing levels of individualism. And when you have isolated individuals separated from families, separated from churches, separated from local communities, from mutual aid societies, et cetera, and this more idea of like individual rights and individual emancipation, what that does is leads to centralization of the political state. And so that's why Alexis de Tocqueville in the 1830s, in his famous book, Democracy in America, in Volume 2, he said, look, we need to be careful to fight against centralization. He said, what kind of despotism will America have? He called it a soft despotism. He said, I look around and I see masses of people circling around, looking after their individual petty and banal, boring pleasures.
Michael Miller visiting today with Cynthia Davis. Cynthia, thank you so much for pinch hitting for Phyllis.
And thank you for letting us be here today. It's been a thrill talking with Michael Miller. And Michael, as you've explained, it's important to connect our good intentions with the poor and help have a biblical understanding of how we're going to make a difference. So listeners can share this interview with a friend, and you can find out more about what's going on at the Poverty Cure at Eagle Forum. That's the website, is eagleforum.org.